Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Jill Levy Fish from the Saving Babies Through Screening Foundation. So tell me a little bit about the Saving Babies Through Screening Foundation.
Save Babies Through Screening Foundation was founded in 1998 by a family who lost their son to a disorder detectable through newborn screening. We are the only newborn screening advocacy group in the country, in the United States. We work to improve the lives of babies to try to make sure there's no disparity amongst the states as far as how many disorders are screened for, and we provide parent education. We are an all-volunteer-run organization, and we just work from donations. Everybody who works with us has been touched by newborn screening in some way and is very passionate about it.
So, what types of conditions are generally screened for?
The program is broken down into three segments, so to speak. So you have hearing, there's the hearing screening, and there's pulse oximetry screening, which is a little sensor that's put on the toe after birth, and it can detect some congenital heart defects. The biggest part of it is the metabolic screening, which with just a few blood spots on a card, we can screen for and detect 60 disorders now that can cause permanent disability or death if they're not picked up early and treated.
So, once screening is complete, do you work with a family or an organization to provide referrals in any way?
Well, what usually happens is when the screening is complete, if the family gets a positive result, there has to be some follow-up done, and that is generally handled through the state. They're referred to a metabolic center, unless, of course, it's something like a heart condition, and then it's taken care of in the hospital. We do help families. We have an 800 number that's on our website, and we can help with referrals, but generally it's handled by the state newborn screening programs, but we're always there to help, and we do help all the time.
So how do you get the word out about the work that you do?
Well, we do our best to do that. I mean, we try to do whatever we can to let people know about us and about the importance of newborn screening. We utilize really whatever avenue we can find, social media, exhibiting at conferences, whatever we can do, things like this, radio interviews, if we're lucky enough to be found and asked to participate. And we provide educational materials. We have a newborn screening DVD that's being used in all the states here and over 60 countries. And we've done some language translations, and all of our educational materials are provided at no cost. So we just want there to be a way for everybody to get the education into their hands without it costing anything. As far as raising awareness about us and the screening, we just really do whatever we can. I mean, we'll even talk to people in stores, you know, just however you can get the word out. That's exactly what we'll do.
So, in your time with the foundation, what sorts of challenges have you seen?
Well, there, I think, are several different challenges. I mean, you know, first of all, like I said earlier, the disparity as far as what disorders are screened for. In the United States, each state sets their own laws as to how many disorders are screened. So you can live in one state and get everything in another state and only have access to a certain number of disorders. And that's one of the things we are very focused on with our education, so that families are aware that they may not be getting everything for their baby that's available. So that's, you know, definitely a challenge as far as, you know, educating the public and then also working with, you know, the states and government trying to get everybody on a level playing field so that the babies get the best start they can. You know, I would say the other biggest challenge we really have is fundraising, because when you have an organization like this and we all work as volunteers, and everything that we do is given for free and produced at no cost, that's really probably, aside from the disparity, the biggest challenge that we have is funding.
So, to look at the converse side of things, in your time with the foundation, is there any one success moment that stands out for you?
I would say, you know, there are several. I mean, you know, when you speak to a family who's been in a position where they have a baby who's been screened successfully and the baby's doing well, I mean, that's, you know, a huge success, even if it's one family that's impacted. I would say probably one of the biggest moments for us is we were involved in the writing and passage of the Newborn Screening Saves Lives Act, which was signed into law several years ago. And I think that was a really pivotal moment in the world of newborn screening. We never had any legislation like that before, and I think that was something that was, you know, quite huge for all of us.
So, if you could send any one message about the importance of getting babies screened, what would you say?
As far as the importance, you know, here in the United States, newborn screening is a public health program. So every baby, when they're born, is being screened, and they're being given access to newborn screening. You know, I think that the, you know, what people need to really take away is that these disorders don't necessarily run in families. These babies can look like every other healthy baby in the nursery. And just because something may seem to be rare doesn't mean that it won't hit your family. And that people need to be just as educated as possible so that if they're not getting all the testing where the baby's being born, that they find a way to get it, they ask for it, they contact us, and we can help, and that they're just as knowledgeable as they can be, because, you know, if they do get that phone call, you know, that there's a positive result, we don't want people to be scared. It's a screening test like anything else, and it just raises a red flag, but that phone call could really be your lucky day, because if your baby does have one of these disorders and they're found early, it's life-changing.
So, what are the next immediate steps for the foundation? The next steps for the foundation's work.
Well, we're going to continue what we're doing, providing the education, speaking at conferences, working on really trying to raise funds so we can add to our educational materials, because that's just so vitally important. Nobody else is doing what we're doing. And to continue to fight for the babies, you know, not just in the United States, but all over the world, it's very concerning that there aren't robust newborn screening programs in every country. And, you know, that's something that we are focused on, and we're hoping at some point, if we get lucky enough, to get a grant to bring newborn screening to other countries that don't have programs now.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
It's a testament to the recognition that all life is important and sacred, that there are screening measures in place for these young children. Fact is, if a disability or a disease or something that would affect a child for life can be detected and prevented ahead of time, it's our responsibility as a society to take whatever steps we can. Fact is, the potential of any given life is unknown. A child may grow up to invent a new rocket for NASA, or cure the deadliest disease. They may be an artist, they may be a teacher. The fact is, we owe it to these children to give them every opportunity, every chance to be at their best and then to reach their best. It's organizations like the Foundation that are so devoted to their work, that are just based on the idea that a thing can be done to make things better for these kids. It really is remarkable, the work they do, just bringing to light these matters of the need for more and more screening, more tests. It's just can be a simple precaution, but it can also be something that really does affect, and yes, even save a life. Small organizations that work in disability life seem to be the most committed. If they start at a grassroots level, they can make a difference on the individual plane. It's just a matter of getting the word to the right person. But if it means bringing together somebody who really does understand, maybe someone who can offer insights and a solution that one alone would not or could not have thought of, really, it is what their work is all about. Just bringing people together to find common purpose, to find hope. Truth is, that's what disability life is all about. Taking what was once a hopeless situation and saying, all right, these are the circumstances. What can we do? How can we make this better? 9 times out of 10, there's something that can be done. Maybe it's not a cure, but it can be a step. Something to prolong a life, to improve the quality of life. And that in itself is a victory. But, like any victory, it's important not to rest on our laurels, not to say, we've taken this step forward and it's good enough. Just, things get lost that way. If a person with a disability can have one step forward to have their quality of life improved, other steps can and must follow. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Hiatus House is a social service agency offering confidential intervention for families experiencing domestic violence, including the Crisis Intervention Program, Residential Program, Transitional and Housing Support Program, Crossroads Program, Fresh Start Men's Program, Fresh Start Women's Program City, Fresh Start Women's Program Country, in the Hiatus House school-based program. If you are interested or for more information, please contact us. Call us at 519-252-7781 or visit our website at www.hiatushouse.com or come to our location at 250 Lewis Avenue, Windsor. Contact Hiatus House. Get safe. Get help.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Jill Levy Fish from the Saving Babies Through Screening Foundation. In this segment of our show, we're going to be chatting a little bit about disabilities in theater. Here to help with that are Stephanie Craig and Angelica Haggart. So tell me a little bit about disabilities in theater.
You want me to go?
Sure. Okay.
All right, so disability in theater is something that's really important to me. I think that people struggle to understand that just because you may have a disability or someone may have a disability, that theater is not something that's outside of the realm of possibility. Places, I know directors that are very hesitant to cast someone with a disability due to a variety of things, but mostly because usually the script doesn't call for it. And so that's one of my big things that I try and push on my director friends is it doesn't matter if the script calls for it or not. Someone with a disability can be used just as easily as an actor.
As an actress with a disability, I completely agree with that. I've been acting in community theater here in Windsor for almost 15 years, and it's been extremely rare that I've worked with anyone either in the cast or the crew that has had a noticeable disability. There may be instances of individuals with invisible disabilities that haven't disclosed to anyone, but as for anyone with any sort of physical or developmental disability that's prominent, I can't think of a time when I've really noticed anyone. And I also agree with what Angelica said about directors being hesitant to cast individuals with disabilities. In a lot of the scripts that you see, it's very rare to have a character that has a specific disability. And oftentimes, if you see in plays or even movies, people have such a stereotypical view of certain character types and how they're to be portrayed. So, for instance, in all my 15 years of acting, I've never been cast as a romantic lead or even a romantic supporting character because of my height. I'm 4'2". It's not something that is seen on stage as something that would look good. Theater is very visual. And to have two characters interacting with such a major height difference, I think, is something that a lot of individuals don't even really think about when they're going through the casting process.
So, do you think theater is kind of reflective of disability life? That a person with a disability has a choice to play the role that's expected of them by society or to give it their own interpretation?
I think that it can be really difficult to make that decision as someone with a disability. I myself have an invisible disability, and choosing whether or not to disclose that is always an internal struggle. It's really difficult to decide whether I'm going to let someone know. Is it going to cost me the job? Is it going to cost me the role? Or is it going to make me more of a selling point? You know, or are they going to take advantage of what I have to offer because of what I've been through? So I think that choosing whether or not to disclose it is a thing all in itself. And I can't imagine when I was in a wheelchair, I just never even bothered. I never even tried. So I just kind of stayed in the shadows.
Exactly. I think it really depends on what you're comfortable with as a person, if you're comfortable in disclosing. And also being willing to talk to people about, even if you don't want to disclose your own disability, but about the area of disabilities in theater, and encourage people that you know who are involved in theater to go outside of their comfort zones when it comes to, in terms of casting or crew or volunteers, any of that area that surrounds the theater. And as Angelica mentioned, if you are a person with disabilities interested in becoming a member of the theater community, look to your strengths. If there's things that you can do that other people can't, make sure to mention them during the interviews or auditions. For example, a lot of times I might go for roles that call for children to be in situations where a lot of time people might not feel comfortable casting small children in. So for example, a few years ago in a play I did, I was cast as a child prostitute who gets molested by a bishop. Not something you'd want a young child to do, but in that case, if any of the audience members speaking after the show expresses concerns to anyone in the show, they could say, oh, you know, it's okay, she's 20 years old. You know, everyone felt completely comfortable during the rehearsal process. So, yeah, just, you know, play for your strengths.
So one thing I've always found in disabilities in theater, it's kind of a mixed bag. For someone without a disability to play someone who has one, example, Patrick Stewart, and for someone who has a disability to play somebody without, must be kind of a challenge. Any thoughts on this?
I think in both terms it can be very challenging. If you're trying to portray someone who has a disability and you are not familiar with that disability or you don't personally have that disability, you always run the risk of stereotyping or insulting or coming across as rude or as joking. So it can be really difficult to portray someone with a disability. And then as someone with a disability, to be asked to hide that for a role, I mean, I would be very offended, because I don't think that is something that you shouldn't have to hide it. It should be just played into the character. It doesn't. One of my favorite examples is on CSI, the coroner. He walks with sticks. He has no legs, essentially, and walks with sticks. And it's almost never mentioned as a character trait. And he actually has that condition. He actually is disabled. And the role, when they wrote it, when they auditioned for it, didn't call for a disabled actor. But they liked his acting so much that they just played it into the character. And I think it's only been mentioned once in the 15 years that CSI has been on the air. So I really like that aspect of it, of just letting it be, just letting it exist.
So that's kind of the thing. Disability is one aspect of who a person is, but it shouldn't be underplayed or overplayed. It shouldn't be ignored, but it shouldn't be exaggerated either.
Exactly. And I think, as you mentioned, in terms of casting, a lot of people, if you read internet message boards about TV shows, they have very strong opinions in terms of if an individual with a disability has been cast as a character without a disability, or an individual without a disability has been cast as a character with a disability. For example, on Glee, the actor who plays Artie is not actually in a wheelchair. And a lot of people who are in wheelchairs are offended that they cast an individual without the disability. I know that can be a very strong emotion for people who have that specific disability to see someone like them on TV or in the movies, but know that that individual doesn't actually have that disability in real life. And that's probably something that occurs more in terms of the casting process, and obviously the actors who play those characters have very little to do with the decision. But I think personally, as long as the individual who's involved in playing the character does the work in studying the disability and, you know, takes it very seriously to try and portray the person as well as they can, then, you know, I would hope people will be accepting of that and look at it as an opportunity for people to learn something about disabilities that they didn't get the opportunity to before.
Well, on the other hand, isn't it possible that by creating such a role, that these writers, these directors, simply want to bring attention to these conditions?
I wish that was the case. I really think that would be a fantastic way to show the world about disabilities. You know, like the purple people players and yes. The Blacklight Theater and all that things. You know, that is such a great way to embody a disability and to show the world really what people are capable of beyond the disability. But I don't think that's really what Glee was going for.
No.
in the system there is I don't think that their goal was to show what it was like to be in a wheelchair. I think it just was, you know, they're trying to show what maybe an average school looked like. But yeah, I mean, I wish that was the case.
I think, you know, in the last few years, diversity has really become a major thing on television, especially. And so I think, like Angelica said, you get a lot of times where individuals creating these shows and casting look for individuals with diversity in order to make their show seem diverse, but don't really focus a lot on bringing attention to the various diversities.
So if you could send any one message about the need for disabilities to be included within theater, what would it be?
I think my message to people with disabilities is don't give up, don't stop fighting. I was told at one point that I shouldn't be doing my BA in drama because I had a disability, and I said, no, you're wrong, and I kept pushing, and I got my BA in drama. And then to the directors and producers, I'd say don't be afraid to see where it goes. Don't be afraid to see what you can get out of it.
Exactly. I have to definitely agree with Angelica. To individuals involved with directing and casting shows, please be open to everyone who comes to audition, whether they're auditioning for acting or interested in assisting behind the scenes. If you have concerns, you know, feel free to bring them up and ask questions. They're not going to be offended, and they'll probably be happy to be able to inform you about the situation further and, you know, be able to demonstrate what you can do. And for individuals with disabilities who are interested in getting into the theater and acting, say just keep trying, keep going to auditions, keep getting your name and your face out there. You know, I've been working in the theater community for 15 years, and I've found some directors who have been very willing to work with me and, you know, very interested in learning more about what things are like for me as an actor with a disability. And, you know, you will find those people who are willing to take chances on you. So please just don't give up.
like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
of course. Steph is actually involved in an upcoming production of The Birds at the Quarterzone Theater. You can go and you can check out the show. With her involved, I'm sure it's going to work out great. It's going to be running through the upcoming weekend, and just get on out there and give it a shot. And now a location piece in which I interviewed a disabilities author. So I'm here with playwright Christy Mason. She's going to be telling us all about her latest work.
This is a play that I write, that I wrote like 2 years ago. And I forgot all about it until three months ago. And it's called The Life of Mantis Point. Basically, it's about this singer whose name is Mantis Point, wanting a normal life, you know. And she meets her first boyfriend. And she gets into a little bit of trouble when the bully Troy, who has a complete obsession with her, actually kidnaps her in the night. And then they rescue her before the morning, before she has a concert at Casino Windsor, now known as Caesar's Windsor. And she meets this reporter who falls in love with her named Billy Bradford, and they go off dating. And her friends she meets at her concert, Skyly, Susan, and Katrina, who are good friends of hers as well, and they help her through the difficult times she has. And at one point, she gets warned by her fans, like near the very end, and they help, they pull her out of there, and it's kind of a mystery. And it's romantic, too. I mean, in one part of the during when Billy rescues her from Troy in the alley, Mantis actually says one of a damsel in distress question is, how do I show me appreciation? And then they share a kiss. It's kind of like that. So yeah, that's basically a big sum up of the play, of what it's about.
So what was the inspiration behind the work?
I've always wanted to be a singer, and I wrote my own song. It's called You Discovered Me. It's basically based off the play, Mantis, who writes that song because her little brother, they actually happen to own Cedar Point as well. And that's, she's named after the ride that's now gone. I'm disappointed about that. Mantis, which is now called the Rougarou. But I'm excited for that too. And so she gets famous because of Dragster, who posted her singing that song on YouTube. And then, yeah, so this is basically a spin-off of that.
So, were there any challenges when you were writing it?
The long 2 year period that I forgot about it. It was writer's block, and I couldn't write anymore. And then when I found it 4 months ago, I started writing again.
So, if you could send any one message about your writings and the work that you've done, what would you say?
Say that again.
If you could send any one message to the community that you want to share about your work, what would you say?
I'd say that if this play goes published, I would say read it and maybe act it out.
And has there been any one success in all your writing that you want to share with us?
Yeah, my book that you last interviewed me on, of Adventures of the Adventures of Connecticut, Connecticut's Grand Journey to Grand Central Station.
For those who weren't as familiar with that interview, could you take me through a little bit of it?
Yeah, you simply asked me where I got the idea, and I told you of Madagascar when Melman wanted to go to Connecticut, and that's where I got the name from. And my aunt wrote, Shelley helped me write it and publish it. And she's the author of Greenhouse Kids. And she inspired me to write my book. And the setting was Grand Central Station, where Marty got caught. Sorry, I said Melman. Marty got caught at Grand Central Station, so that was the setting.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.